Welcome to Unexpected Points. I am your host, Kevin Cole. I am joined today by Ringer staff writer Kalen Jones. Kalen is covering the NFL, first year covering the NFL, and we were talking a little bit before the podcast where he's covering it like a true blogger because you don't get to go out there and do anything, so you just got to cover it from your basement, and then people can yell at you about the fact that you don't watch the games and you're just hanging out at home and you know nothing about football. So welcome to the NFL experience.
It's been fun, you know, getting acquainted with Game Pass, actually having access to Game Pass. That was new this year. That was fun. Getting to see all 22 all the time. That was fun.
Oh, my God. I remember at the beginning of the year, there was an all 22 kerfuffle. I don't know if you remember. Yep. You may not have been part of this.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I did not realize that. I mean, this was bigger, I think, than a delay. Actually, this is probably a bad joke, but I was going to delay in the COVID vaccine. Like, the people were just going insane for how little access that they had to the All-22. It was like, I didn't realize how much of the ecosystem out here. And I mean, there is so much great analysis that people are doing nowadays because of that democratizing aspect of having the All-22 to anyone who can, you know, pony up the dollar, the whatever, $60, $70 for a Game Pass subscription.
Yeah, no, I think it's really good because the NFL, it allows, you know, everyone to really understand what they're watching, and also because, you know, the game just allowing, you know, people to understand it at a more granular level. I think that really helps as far as like growing the game and getting more people interested, and it just helps with basic comprehension of the game, you know, just like, yeah, you know, with PFF, like they work hand in hand, film and the analytics. I think it goes hand in hand in helping people really understand football. At least,
yeah. And that's why I appreciate the work that you do there. I mean, I remember that you had reached out to me a while back about getting some numbers around EPA and scrambling. So immediately you vault right to the top of the favorite football writers list, as long as you're willing to put some of the nerd stats in there. But like you're saying, it's just good. It adds an additional layer of context. It gives you a jumping off point, I feel like, in a lot of discussions too, when people are talking about, because ultimately when it comes down to it, people are saying what is more valuable, X or Y, and then you're kind of building back from that with all the different analysis. So I think it is a good starting point to at least come from, and then you can explain the context behind the numbers that you're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, what makes honestly discussing the game so much more fun. And it's interesting because we've evolved so much. You know, I can speak for myself. I'm only 24, but you know, 10 years ago, when you're watching, like, you know, First Take and people yelling, basically, and, you know, basic football analysis, like, it's not the level that it is now. Like, the fact that we have, like, the national championship simulcast, like, stuff where you have coaches who are sitting and explaining what they are seeing, in addition to, you know, the regular broadcast where you just hear someone talking about what they're seeing. It's very fascinating. And again, like, I love PFF, you know, for me, because I grew up, you know, most people my age and I grew up playing Madden. So when I was in high school, I always thought, man, it'd be really cool if someone could just like take, you know, what players are doing and put grades on them, make an arbitrary number like Madden. And honestly, not to, I guess, like lower the level of like what you guys are doing, but it's super helpful as opposed to, you know, explaining the game and understanding what a player is good at and who's good and what they do well. It's super helpful, man.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, there is so much more out there. It was funny. I watched the broadcast. ESPN had a simulcast. I want to say it was for Ravens Titans, where Dan Orlovsky, Mina Kimes, I believe Marcus Spears was in there too. I don't know if it was the whole crew that was there from NFL Live, and they were doing the game. Yeah. And I found that fascinating. I mean, I found that great. I mean, I think generally the level of commentary is pretty good in the NFL. We're doing a pregame sort of show at PFF, and I think the level of commentary there could maybe take a step up us over these networks. So I think that's a place there. And I saw this very interesting thing last year where Amazon is kind of getting into the NFL rights. You know, they stream some stuff on their Prime Video service. And last year for one of the games, and we'll see if maybe they do this going forward, they were allowing people to have the official rights and stream themselves, selected people, so they could kind of give commentary on the game. So I think maybe that's where it'll go eventually. It's just like all the different choices that you have for everything, that you'll have choices for the analysis that you want to hear. And that's why it's good to hear unique perspectives out there.
Absolutely. Totally agree with that.
All right, so let's jump into the topical stuff here. Obviously, we're coming off of Championship Sunday. I'll just come straight off the top here. I was a little bit ambivalent about who I wanted to see win these games. It's interesting. I don't know if you ever had this phenomenon, but I thought going into the Tampa Bay Green Bay game that I didn't care who won. And then once it started playing, I started rooting more for the Bucks than versus the Packers. Did you have any rooting interest or just an interest on who you thought would be the best Super Bowl?
Man, that's a good question, because I think I fell into that bucket where I didn't care necessarily who won, because, you know, the narrative talk either way was going to emerge, because it, assuming, I was hoping that the Chiefs would win. That's the only team,
right,
that,
yeah,
you know,
I was hoping. Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, Bills Mafia, we're sorry, Bills Mafia, but right, yeah, I think most people were hoping for that.
Yeah, I wanted to see Mahomes. And I think that's the thing, like sport, the definition of sport, you know, it has to do with competitive entertainment. And the most entertaining teams, in my opinion, at least involve the Chiefs. And either one of, you know, quarterback play is so important in, you know, what we determine to be one, a good team, and what we determine to be entertaining. You know, I wouldn't have cared either way seeing Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers in that Super Bowl. But I think we got the better result, because I think at the end of the day, like, we, at least for me, I can say that I want to see the winningest quarterback who finds a way, and Tom Brady, he always finds these ways to somehow end up in a winning position, go against Mahomes and the Chiefs, who seem to, regardless of whatever the circumstances are, so far they've been a buzzsaw and just kind of they haven't mauled teams, but last week that was the team that, you know, a lot of us expected to see throughout the entire season. So I think that's why it's super exciting, because I think we got the two most talented teams going up against one another in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, Green Bay was a favorite in that game. Maybe they would be seen as being slightly more talented. I could see how your football, more of an aficionado, someone who really follows it, maybe would want the Packers, thinking that they might have been a better team. But certainly from the perspective of bringing in, you know, these incremental fans, casual fans, Tom Brady is going to be a much bigger name there. Even though, you know, Rodgers was on this kind of GOAT trajectory at one point in time. Someone who's gone to the Super Bowl 10 times versus someone who's gone to the Super Bowl, you know, one time, it's going to make a huge difference as far as people who are only around to watch the biggest games of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of raises the stakes, because, you know, that's the narrative that we're going to hear for the next 2 weeks. And now for the rest of Patrick Mahomes' career, you know, has to do with, you know, whether or not he's going to be able to catch Tom Brady. And I mean, he's the only one that looks like he's going to be capable of doing it in the league right now, considering that he has the chance to win a second Super Bowl by, what, 25 years old. I mean, it's crazy. But also, if Brady wins, then it gives him 7 Super Bowl titles, which is absolutely absurd. And it just makes I think, like, when you look at the Chiefs' window to win right now, so early in Mahomes' career, whether or not, you know, 10 years from now, we're going to be able to talk about and discuss whether or not Mahomes is able to, you know, even come close to that standard. I mean, this is just going to spark so much discussion for literally decades to come. It's very fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, there's talk out there, and I can't say I disagree with it, that Mahomes, in some people's minds, is saying, you know, this is maybe the best I've ever seen the position being played, which may have been said about Rodgers also, like back in his 2011, 2012, 2013 run that he had there, multiple MVPs before he had a bit of a rough spot there. So yeah, it'll be interesting going forward. But what I was thinking about going into this, there was a lot of talk about legacy and all these for both games. I mean, I didn't think the AFC was as important for legacy wise, because even if the Bills won somehow, Josh Allen, while it's a huge mark to have gone to a Super Bowl, you still could end up in this quarterback who had gone to one Super Bowl unless you had consistent play and continued to follow it up. Mahomes, yeah, it would have been bad, but I think most people see him as the best quarterback in the NFL right now going forward. On the other side, I thought this game was most important for Aaron Rodgers as far as his legacy is concerned than anyone else. And it's kind of what I was hinting at earlier, that within the game he's seen as this high-level player, but he just doesn't have the Super Bowl rings, only one. And again, even in the play in these conference championships games, not that it's necessarily his fault, but now he's 1-3 in these conference championship games. Do you think this where do you put Rodgers after this? Do you put any blame on him for this particular game or this performance or the fact that they did not come through?
Yeah, I sat on this one a lot when you sent it to me. It's I don't know where I put Rodgers, because the guy's been on the doorstep now 5 times, and he's come up short 4 different times. And I was looking at the teams that he lost, so, you know, it's teams that were really, really talented on defense, you know, the Falcons, the Seahawks, the 49ers in last year's game, and then this year the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So the teams that he lost to, I would argue, had more talent. At least in my mind, they had more talented rosters, or at least they were able to hit Green Bay where they were deficient at. But I don't know what his legacy will be, because for me, he was, before Patrick Mahomes came into the league, there, to me, I think he was in that discussion and probably the top of it as the most talented person who had played the position, like you mentioned earlier. And it was a really strange, you know, development, because when you watch his tape at Cal, like, he looks like a completely different player. But, you know, no one had played the position the way that he had until he came into the league, someone with the aesthetic that he had. And honestly, he might have the prettiest aesthetic of any quarterback that's ever played, but Mahomes is more talented. Like, I don't know how else to explain that, and he's going to have the rings potentially. He has, you know, the rest of his career to keep counting up rings and, you know, really surpass where Aaron Rodgers was as far as legacy is concerned, and especially in the ring discussion. So I don't know where Rodgers will end up falling for most people. I asked my younger brother last night, just trying to get like what the younger generation's perspective of Rodgers would be. And he was like, you know, people my age only see him as like an above average quarterback, well, a top tier quarterback who just never won Super Bowls, similar to Drew Brees. He kind of falls in that bucket of guys who just didn't win Super Bowls, but kind of falls in the what if category, or probably should have been, in terms of what their talent presented and what their teams lived up to being. So it's really interesting. Kind of like, I don't want to say Brett Favre, because that's the name that kept coming up to me, because, you know, obviously, besides being a legendary Packer quarterback with awesome commercials, who's probably going to be on our TV screens for the next 10 years. You know, the way that I heard about Brett Favre get talked about by people older than me was this guy who had insane talent, just never really won that many Super Bowls. And it's kind of fallen in the same bucket in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Favre, one difference potentially, I mean, I probably have to do research just to make sure I have the overlapping years correct, but yes, I think the NFC was pretty stacked. Was pretty stacked back right then, with the Cowboys, and the 49ers were very competitive. I would say Rodgers in some ways had a little bit of an easier time. I mean, the Seahawks were there, right? So the Seahawks were competitive right for a while. But the AFC, just for the fact that you got away from the Patriots, you know, if you're in the NFC, was a big deal. I mean, a team that, like, you know, Brady, again, he had 9 Super Bowl appearances before taking up all of this space over there. And then you had Big Ben with a few. And, you know, a Flacco here or there for good measure. And then now Mahomes may be filling that same role there. So I think that he maybe had more of a chance there. All first-time depositors at Monkey Knife Fight that put at least $20 into their account while using promo code PFF will receive a free PFF Annual Edge subscription. That's a $40 value for just $20, and you'll get the opportunity to turn that $20 into even more money playing daily fantasy and prop games at one of the fastest-growing fantasy sports sites in the USA in Monkey Knife Fight. Go to Monkey Knife Fight and deposit your $20 with promo code PFF today and receive your free PFF Edge annual subscription. And I'll say another way that I think Rodgers is different, and I think this came into play in this game a bit, at least in how you contrast him to Tom Brady. I mean, you might not be familiar with this, but there was some criticism of Rodgers in the dark circles of some analytics web, where looking at him and saying, flipping things that are supposed to be positives on their head, like the fact that he has this insane TD INT ratio, right? He never throws interceptions, and people would say, well, you know, if your team's only winning 10 games a season, which he was in some years worse, like, maybe you should be throwing more interceptions. Maybe you should be taking more chances. And if you looked at what Tom Brady did, you should be taking more chances, which would then result in more interceptions, I guess is the way. And you look at what Tom Brady did this last game. I mean, he had those 3 interceptions. But when I look through some of the advanced stats, his numbers didn't look that bad because, you know, if you're throwing a 30-yard interception on 3rd-and-2 when you're about to get sacked, it's not really that bad of a play. When he's throwing up a jump ball like Chris Godwin ended up getting in that part of the game. Again, that was another one where very easily could have been an interception that he's throwing up there. Now, Rodgers did throw an interception, but it wasn't in that same way. But I think some people do look at his performance, and at least comparing to what Brady has done, another guy who has a very low interception rate over his career, but Brady was willing to just put it up for grabs sometime where it seemed like the risk was appropriate. And he was rewarded. I mean, you could call it luck, but you have to put yourself in a position to be lucky also.
Yep. And that's the thing with Tom Brady. You know, I think throughout the course of his career, you know, he's been very, very fortunate, but you have to put yourself in the situation to be lucky in order to be lucky, like you just mentioned. And I think, you know, people who look at Rodgers and say like, hey, he probably should have taken more chances. I don't disagree with that, but the efficiency within the structure of the offenses that he's played in, and the fact that he operated at such a high level, I don't know if we can always pin it on, you know, him just not taking more chances. I think, you know, what he was able to do and, you know, the course of his career, I don't know if I'll knock him for not being more aggressive and pushing the ball downfield. You know, like, I think he's done that enough. It's just, it's felt like, honestly, it's been more team centered, like shortcomings, as opposed to it falling on Aaron Rodgers. Majority of the time, there's definitely been performances where, you know, he's been the cause of them not winning. But I don't know if I agree totally with the whole he should be throwing more interceptions.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's very easy to mock because it's like, oh yeah, interceptions. Let's do more of that. That's a great thing. But I mean, I think there's some truth to it, but again, not as much. And I also, right, like you mentioned the surrounding team. I mean, that's a big thing where it used to be part of the Peyton versus Brady comparison, where the reality was that the two of them, from their own stats, offensively had those teams, didn't really perform that differently. It's just the Patriots had this really, really great defense, especially in those early years when Brady was winning championships. Now, Brady has really turned it on in the last 4 or 5 years since Peyton Manning has been retired. I mean, he was awesome in 2017, even though they didn't win the Super Bowl that year against the Eagles. And he just trailed off last year. Before that, he was pretty good too. But he still does have this good defense. And where Rodgers, on the other hand, surprising, because I don't necessarily think of the Packers' defenses as being, you know, bottom barrel, but of the major big time quarterbacks who played in the playoffs, he does have the worst defense as far as on average how they've performed in the playoffs for him.
Yeah, and I think that was honestly the biggest shortcoming. Like, you look at the formula for beating Tom Brady, like over the course of years, has always been get pressure on him. I think Next Gen Stats had, you know, Brady as getting pressure like 5 times, you know, last week. Like, that's absurd. And I think a lot of the credit, one, goes to Tampa Bay having an elite, or at least a top tier offensive line, especially in Tristan Wirfs over there at tackle. But, you know, the Packers just didn't have, they had a non-existent pass rush. And then you look at the opposite, you flip it where Green Bay didn't have David Bakhtiari. Their offensive line look, I mean, even in the previous matchup early this year, you know, Tampa Bay was able to generate pressure. They had Vita Vea, who was able to completely disrupt things in the middle of the pocket, and you had Shaq Barrett and JPP off the edge. Like, there was just too much as far as the surrounding parts. I think in this matchup, when I look at it, I just thought that was the biggest difference, that Green Bay's defense, I mean, even when you look at the secondary and what they have in terms of, you know, the greatness of Jair Alexander, and then the drop off between him and Kevin King, who, you know, I don't mean to pick on him again. I mean, it's
R.I.P.
Yeah, it's such a significant drop-off. I mean, you look at the receiving corps. Devontae Adams is in one tier, and Alan Lazard and MVS are in another. And it's just these drop-offs in talent, as opposed to the steadiness of, I mean, Tampa Bay, and even looking at the AFC, the Chiefs and the Bills, like, there isn't too much of a drop-off, you know, between the elite parts and, you know, the what should be a number two pieces for them. In specific position groups. So I think that rewatching the game, like, that was what really stood out to me and felt like the major difference between the two squads.
Yeah. And obviously people on that Scotty Miller touchdown, he wasn't our dearly deceased, was not necessarily put in the best position on that, right, also with that coverage. So yeah, I think it's those calling. All those things come together, and when they're all hitting right, they're hitting right, and when they're not, they're not. It's interesting. You mentioned Bakhtiari and his injury. Yeah, I was looking at some of the numbers. I mean, it was a pretty limited sample when he was out, but it looked like the Packers' offensive line, since he had been out, was not giving up more pressures on average per drop back, but but Billy Turner was, for those that were credited specifically to him. I mean, it was something absurd for Bakhtiari, where he's only given up like three pressures or four pressures the entire year or something like that. So the fact that Turner had given up, I think it was 9 or 10 in the games that he had played, didn't, you know, in the few games he played, wasn't that bad. But again, like in this game, you know, he gave up four pressures, and there were also just everyone, both Billy Turner and Rick Reiner combined gave up seven pressures, and this, it was just really effective pressure as far as how often they were able to sack Rodgers too. So that was a huge difference in this game. Finally, the 2021 NFL Draft Guide is out with 150 player profiles, everything you need to be on top of things well before we get to April when your team is on the clock. You can get it with an Edge or Elite subscription. Use promo code SuperBowl25 and get 25% off those subscriptions, and that promo code is active through Monday after the Super Bowl. That's 25% off an annual Edge or Elite subscription, which includes the 2021 NFL Draft Guide with promo code SuperBowl25. Now, maybe do a little bit of Super Bowl preview here for this thing. So this Tampa, the Tampa Bay defense, where do we rate them versus, okay, I would say this. So I thought the 49ers defense last year was really almost perfect for what you would want to have go up against it. And it worked for maybe 2.5 quarters, something like that, fairly well. I think this Tampa Bay defense is maybe close, even though they got completely smoked, at least in the first three quarters against Patrick Mahomes earlier this year when Tyreek Hill had, I think, 200 yards in the first half or whatever he ended up having there. Do you think that defense can compete now with the Chiefs?
I don't know.
That's probably the most honest answer that you could come up with here.
I hate having an answer. I mean, when you look at, you know, Tampa Bay secondary, there's so many young guys there, and they're definitely talented. Like Sean Murphy Bunting and Carlton Davis, like those are very talented cornerbacks. And we've seen, like, I think throughout the year, they had so many different up and down performances between the two of them because they're just getting acclimated. But we saw last week and even the week before that, and at several points this year, like they're capable of playing at a high level. I don't know if they're going to be able to slow down Patrick Mahomes. I think it comes down to how much, again, you know, we can say try to get pressure on Patrick Mahomes. That could be the way to beat him. I know that was part of the formula for when the Raiders beat them back in, I think, week 6 or week 7 this year. But I don't know if that's going to be enough to slow down Patrick Mahomes, because even if Tampa Bay, let's say they were able to jump out early and get out to an impressive start, I think it was Seth Kaiser who wrote about how, you know, Patrick Mahomes, you know, and the Chiefs, ever since he's become the starting quarterback in 2018, they're just on another planet in terms of EPA and the rest of the league, in terms of what they're able to do per play. And when they're down in football games, like, they're just a buzzsaw. It does not matter what you do against this team. So I don't know. Like, the honest answer is I don't know if there is a way that you could slow them down. Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill, if you slow them down, now you're dealing with Sammy Watkins, Mecole Hardman, and even potentially Clyde Edwards-Helaire and the rest of that running game. Like, it's a buzzsaw. I don't know what to do against them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's been this question as to whether or not the Chiefs are a team that can turn it on, you know, because they've been playing better in the playoffs this year after not being so great during the regular season this year. It was a similar circumstance last year. And I don't know. It's really, I mean, reflexively, I would push back against something like that just to assume that, you know, the larger sample, I'm going to throw sample in here, the larger sample, that's more representative of what's going to happen, this and that. But I do think we have a little bit of a hint with the Chiefs and the fact that, like you said, when they've been down, and especially when it's been a third down, when they really need to make a play, they've been so good doing that. So maybe they treat a playoff game like the entire thing is a third down, right? Like, this is like all – this is they really can laser focus in at some times when they really need to. And maybe that explains in part why in the playoffs they can take their game to the next level, because they are locked into that degree in a similar way as they are on the highest leverage plays during the season on third down.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. Like, in the crucial situations, like, I've never seen a team, at least personally, where – you just kind of expect them to convert. It could be 3rd and 13, and you're expecting Patrick Mahomes to find a way to convert it. And then that's the other thing too. Like, their defense, they generate enough turnovers where, you know, they make enough plays to help their offense out. And this is such a high powered unit that, you know, it, even if you have a lead, it can evaporate like that because of what they're able to do in terms of generating explosive plays and just consistently. That's the thing. Like, they do it just so consistently. And I think it's a credit, one, to, you know, Patrick Mahomes and, you know, the skill players that they have, and also Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy, what they're able to do in terms of scheming things up. As far as them being able to turn it on for the postseason, I mean, I thought throughout the entire year, they played 9-1 school games. They went 8-1. Like, and people were questioning, like, whether or not, you know, this was who they would be going into the postseason. And throughout that first half against Cleveland, before, you know, we saw Mahomes really get hurt, I thought they were going to coast to another win. You know, I thought they were going to dominate them. And then Mahomes left and the scoreboard looked completely different than what it probably should have been. And then this game was a, you know, exactly what we expected. I feel like what we expected from the Chiefs throughout the entire year. They just have too much firepower.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about the Chiefs later, but I think they may even like be taking it to the next level defensively in a way too, which is scary. Yeah. when those two things start to come together. But I mean, getting back to Packers Bucks. Okay. So the right. one play everyone's focused on, is the field goal attempt, 4th and goal from the 8-yard line, a little bit over 2 minutes left to go. Instinctually, did you digitally yell on Twitter when that happened, or physically yell at home when you saw what was going on? What was your reaction? And then looking back on it, do you still have the same reaction that you thought at the time?
Yeah, no, because I just kind of, my jaw dropped. I just kind of stared. I'm like, what are they doing? Because, you know, obviously, again, like, my thing, you hear coaches say it all the time, control what you control. And to me, if you have an opportunity against, you know, Tom Brady, that alone, I know, you know, I've been a proponent for, you know, following analytics and trusting, you know, what the numbers say in circumstances. But, and I know we make fun of coaches for saying, oh, it's a gut feeling or it's a morale thing or whatever. But if I'm looking on the other side and I see the one quarterback in the history of the NFL who has somehow made it to 9 Super Bowls at the time, now 10, if I can put him away or at least make his, you know, situation a little bit tougher, I would have taken the chance. I still feel like I would have. But again, I'm someone who makes fun of coaches for saying, oh, I felt I should have done it. I'm being a hypocrite here. But
yeah. I mean, I think the numbers could go either way. I mean, the larger context was that the Packers were in a bad spot. I mean, I don't think people realize this whole one score game thing has become perverted a bit, because it becomes like, oh, it's a one score game. But a one score game does not mean you score a touchdown and you win the game. It means in this instance, you score a touchdown from the 8-yard line, right?
Right.
Then you convert a 2-point conversion to tie the game. Then you give the ball back to the Bucks with 2 minutes left, where they need a field goal to win the game. So then you stop them. Then you go to overtime, and then you win in overtime. So it's like a bunch of different things, guys. It's not you go for it on 4th down, you score the touchdown, and you win, which I think, or you're in a position to win. So I think that's probably part of the decision. Although, like I said, I don't think it really matters that much either way what the choice is. But I think that's probably the thing, is quite often going to overtime is equated with winning a lot of the time. And scoring a touchdown is equated with getting 8 points somehow, even though, again, you're just splitting your odds in half there. Because I think even by Ben Baldwin and his 4th down bot there, he had it being slightly better to go for it. But it was the difference between a 10% win probability and a 9% win probability. So it's still pretty small for what people would have seen as being a quote-unquote one-score game.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, they were in just such a tough position. And then I think what really screwed them over was, you know, the first play that Tampa Bay had after following the kickoff. Like, they got lucky enough to where the 2-minute warning wasn't exhausted. So you have 4 stoppages of play, and on the first play, they gave us a 9-yard play. And so it put them in position to face 2nd and 1, 3rd and 1. That would have exhausted all the timeouts. They were smart enough to, you know, try to allow, or I think they took an intentional penalty, and Tampa Bay, for some reason, accepted the penalty, which, you know, gave them automatic 1st down. But, you know, either way, like you're saying, it was a 10% shot versus a 9% shot. It ultimately, I don't think it would have made a difference. I just think, you know, if you have a shot, if I look on the other sideline and I see Tom Brady, you know, screw the numbers, man. I'm going to try. I'm going to go out blazing, you know, like I got to for the touchdown. Yeah.
I mean, if the numbers were certainly there to make that decision. So again, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have, but I think when we discussed the Bills and some of their decisions, those were much more clear as far as why they shouldn't have done what they ended up doing. PFF and Sunday Night Football's Chris Collinsworth is teaming up with one of the best players on and off the field, 49ers All-Pro cornerback Richard Sherman. The Chris Collinsworth podcast featuring Richard Sherman is available now wherever you find your podcasts. They will provide the most interesting football conversation in sports every single week, and sometimes that means the discussion will venture off the field too. Additionally, Chris will be taking a dive into the game of football as he sees it, inviting in the best and brightest to talk about everything that is happening in the great game of football. Mark your calendars. You do not want to miss the best 60 minutes of Inside this season. But another thing that I thought was interesting is, so after the game, there was a lot of talk about, again, with Rodgers, where Rodgers does this thing where he's not like explicitly throwing anyone under the bus, but he is not throwing them under the bus. In other words, he's not a rah-rah sort of guy, right? I think he's measured rather than being like, I'm going to be fake about something. I'm going to be very measured. He almost reminds me of like kind of like Obama answering questions sometimes, where there's this long pause and then he's coming out. So he's saying, I think, exactly what he wants to say. And when he said after the game that, you know, it's not my decision, I thought that we would have another shot on fourth down. So that in and of itself is kind of a thing there. And then he went even further into talking about, you know, a lot of guys aren't going to be here next year. Maybe I'm one of them, that sort of thing. Are you buying any of this Rodgers dissatisfaction, which could lead to something just jarring for a franchise where he's been there and he's been the guy? They've had two quarterbacks basically for the last 30 years, where he could be someone who actually ends up leaving in the offseason.
I don't know if I buy it. I mean, when you look at Aaron Rodgers, one who's super, super, super thoughtful. I mean, he's, you know, maybe being, you could say it's dramatic, but it's just the reality also true. Like, he legitimately does have no, at least idea of like what everyone else's futures are. Like, that's just a fact of matter. So if you take it from that perspective, as opposed to, you know, looking at, you know, analyzing the tone of his voice or his mannerisms when he said it, you know, it's the truth. Like, no one knows what the future is. That's what it is. And I don't think that he's going to go anywhere. You know, I think the owners came out today, or somebody within the Packers organization said Tuesday that, you know, they would be idiots if they let, you know, Aaron Rodgers go. And they would be idiots if they let Aaron Rodgers go. Like, I don't think that, you know, he's going to go anywhere. I think it was just in the moment. He's a competitor, you know, for him to have gotten there five times. And I think he mentioned that it takes so much for a squad to get to that point, and for him to get there so many times and to not get over the hump for the fourth time. I mean, that's got to be devastating. I can't imagine, because, you know, for fans, for observers, you know, this, if you're a Packers fan, for example, you know, you carry this for a year. If you're an observer, you probably wonder for like 6 months, oh man, they could have done XYZ. But, you know, a year from now, we'll forget about it. Aaron Rodgers, this is his life. For NFL players, that is their life, for that one game to go awry. And again, for them to get there so many times, I understand the gloominess and the woe is me attitude, I guess, because, yeah, I mean, it that sucks. This is your life. This is what you get paid to do. This is what you invest your time in. So for him to come up short again, I'm not surprised that he felt that way, but I don't think he's going to go anywhere. It's just in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, those legacy issues that we talked about are probably hanging on him a bit here. I mean, unfortunately, no matter how good someone is, assuming he has a couple of good years left, I mean, maybe three, you know, maybe four. It depends. I guess nowadays it can extend a bit longer. But, you know, the odds are against him getting to the Super Bowl again, probably, right, when you look at or winning a Super Bowl, but in particular, if you think about 32 teams and Patrick Mahomes isn't going anywhere, and a lot of these guys aren't going anywhere. So, yeah, I think that's part of it. I wonder how much is still on his mind about what happened in the offseason. And there's a little thing going on now where certain Packer backers, you could say, these Packers fans, maybe people who podcast or write on blogs about the Packers, who are trying to defend the draft and the lack of really utility that they got out of the 2020 draft by taking in this season, at least, right? So that, you know, taking Jordan Love in the first round, taking AJ Dillon in the second round, who played some in particular because of the fact that Aaron Jones got injured, but didn't really play for most of the season. Jordan Love, I'm not sure he was even active the entire season. I don't think he was even the backup the entire season. And then Jay Sternberger in the third round, who was played sparingly the entire time. And then in free agency, now they spent a ton in free agency the year before when they brought in Za'Darius and Preston Smith and Adrian Amos and all these guys. But it was really just a couple lateral moves and there wasn't much else there. So I wonder how much he's still thinking about the fact, because I don't think Aaron Rodgers is someone who forgets, who's like water under the bridge. I'm going to forget about these things. I wonder how much he's still thinking about the fact when these comments come out that this is a team that, you know, you're this close to getting, right? You're this close on all these different games of going there. And you had a draft that just really, and especially a first round pick, that was just never in the plans to help you get that marginal benefit that could make the difference between going to a Super Bowl or not.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, looking back at, you know, the draft classes before that, it was really interesting because, you know, over the past like 4 or 5 seasons, you've had at least 2 or 3 guys where the Packers have, you know, hit a bullseye in the sense that, you know, we get a guy who's either a rotational player or he's starting and developing and some. They didn't get anything out of this draft other than, you know, potentially Jordan Love being their quarterback down the road. John Runyon was off the lineman they selected, who didn't appear at all this year, I believe, or played sparingly at the most. So if I were Aaron Rodgers, and again, like we mentioned earlier, if I looked at the squads of, you know, Tampa Bay, what they were able to do. If I were looking at Buffalo, what they were able to surround Josh Allen with, and even Kansas City, like it would be really, really frustrating for me to think, okay, cool, like we have all of these pieces in place, like at least supplement, you know, the elite talents that you have in certain position groups and add someone who's above average or look to improve there. So that way, you know, it gives you that added firepower going into the regular season and the postseason. And it's really strange because you have this quarterback who's proven, at least early on in his career, what he's able to do when he's had, you know, a full cupboard of weapons around. And really since, you know, like mid-2010s, I mean, Green Bay hasn't invested, at least in my opinion, as heavily as they probably could have in giving, you know, Aaron Rodgers, you know, elite weapons. And maybe that has something to do with like it being difficult to recruit players of Green Bay, but if I had the chance to play with Aaron Rodgers and be on path to, again, not face Tom Brady and potentially get to a Super Bowl, I don't know how that was in the selling point.
Yeah. And like I mentioned, a lot of those names we're talking about last year that they brought in, you know, primarily on the defensive side of the ball,
right,
where Rodgers could point to them in these last two conference championships where they couldn't stop where Raheem Mostert was running for like 17 yards a carry, and then this year they're having trouble stopping Tom Brady as not being that great. And I guess when I look at the draft, I mean, I wasn't super low on the Jordan Love pick because you figure, hey, if this is the guy who can be the future, this and that. I was pretty low on AJ Dillon pick just because it's, you know, you can wait, especially when you have Aaron Jones and you have Jamal Williams, and you really want like every year to be productive for a running back who's taken in the first two rounds. I don't think you want to be able to say, oh, this will be our guy to step in if we don't re-sign those two players a year from now. That just seems like a little bit of a waste there. And then, you know, when it came to Sternberger taking him in the third round, I mean, again, tight end, H-back, whatever you want to call them, not really a fast developing position in the NFL. I mean, sometimes you can have them that develop well. So it was almost by design that they were drafting players who were going to be useful in Aaron Rodgers, you know, year 38 season, year 39 season. Yeah. It's almost by design that they were not giving him something there. And I think it's not just saying, oh, this is like a results-based thing and they made picks that could have been helpful, but they got unlucky. I think they really weren't trying to push the chips in on this season, where you see a lot of teams who are doing that, you know, almost every year, conceivably. They seem like they're just going all in over and over again on their aging quarterback.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It has to be frustrating at some point because, in a way, you could say either they're preparing for Rodgers in his 38-39 season or they're preparing for when he's gone. And maybe that is the failsafe, you know, and it makes sense. So, again, that's why the comments, the way that Rodgers presented them, are being analyzed the way that they are, because the Packers set it up this way to where they have a backup plan in place for a contingency whenever he decides to leave. And Rodgers is looking at it like, well, they didn't invest in me while I was at literally a, you know, a career best season in a lot of, in a lot of categories. I don't know, you know, that's the thing. And I think he's being honest when he says a lot of guys' futures are uncertain. It's the fact of the matter.
Yeah, no, that's the, yeah, that is the reality of the NFL. Although when it comes to the franchise quarterback, normally they're not going anywhere unless the team really, really wants them to go. Right. I mean, Deshaun Watson is going to test that this offseason to see if there is such a thing. But I can't really think of another circumstance beyond Carson Palmer just deciding to retire that's ended up or retire pretending to retire before ending up going somewhere. So. Okay, well, let's look at the Bucs opponent. So they're going to be facing the Chiefs. Let's talk about that game a little bit here. You know, it wasn't close, obviously. It was a 9-0 lead, although 6 of those 9 points were scored off of a muffed punt. The first drive for the Chiefs, Tyreek Hill dropped what would have been like a 45-yard completion, and that was the only time they were stopped the entire game. Do you think this is a game after having watched it? Do you think this, because again, this is like there were 3-point favorites, so even a tighter spread than it was in the other game. The Bills were surging going into this. Do you think if they just ran this back, let's say 20 times, 30 times, is it going to be only an incremental like amount of times that the Kansas City is going to win more? Are they going to win 55% of the time? Or was something revealed in this that our perceptions of these teams were wrong and the Chiefs really just are a tier above the Bills and everyone else?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, the Chiefs are definitely a tier above, you know, the Bills.
Like, well, how big of a tier, baby? Is this a little step, or are we talking about, you know, you're on the trampoline and you're trying to get up onto the roof of the house?
Right. And I think that's the thing. Like, it kind of is a trampoline, and it depends. And a lot of it comes down to how well Josh Allen can do. And he kind of reverted to what we had seen, you know, the year previously, where he was taking bad sacks. You know, he was able to do some things with his legs later on in the game, probably could have used his legs a little bit more, but, you know, Kansas City was able to generate consistent pressure on him. So it's not like, you know, he was, you know, out of fault completely for hanging on to the ball too long or anything. You know, Kansas City just turned it on when they needed to. And I don't know if there is, I'm sure there's, you know, a way to, you know, cleanly explain that using numbers and data and even analyzing the game. But it just looks like, you know, Kansas City is just able to flip a switch that, you know, their elite players play like elite players. The way that Chris Jones was able to affect the pocket, the way that Frank Clark was able to play last week. You know, their secondary getting some production from who was it, Rashard Fenton, who they selected a few years ago in like the fourth or fifth round, getting an interception. Like, they just get production out of their guys. And it's crazy that they maximize their players and put themselves in a position to be successful. So again, like, tip of the cap to you know, Steve Spagnuolo for what the job that he was able to do in constructing that game plan to slow Josh Allen down. But until we see a more consistent Josh Allen against these top tier defenses, because the week before, you know, I know that Buffalo won by 2 scores, but Josh Allen didn't play all that well against Baltimore, at least in my opinion. Like, he didn't look that great. And so I wasn't too surprised by him not showing up against Kansas City. I thought he would improve a little bit, but he didn't look that great. And a lot of it had to do with the pressure and the way that Kansas City's secondary was able to affect their receivers, especially using press man coverage. I think that was another key difference last week, too.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the pressure was really interesting. It was the most interesting part of the game, how much pressure they brought, how effective it was, how they weren't burnt. They didn't get burnt on the pressure, where that's part of this. We talk about this one score game thing with the Chiefs. I mean, this is, I'd have to recall all the different plays, but at least anecdotally, you know, they were up multiple scores in some of these games, but they were giving up some big plays in order to let teams back in some of the time. So that didn't really happen. So I thought that was interesting. And because going into this game, you know, if you looked at there's an analytical breakdown. I think Shil Kapadia and some others were doing some good analytical breakdowns at The Athletic, where they were saying, let's look at your splits, your pretty common ones, right? Let's look at man versus zone coverage. Let's look at pressure against the blitz versus not against the blitz. And Josh Allen this season was playing like Patrick Mahomes light as far as destroying man coverage and destroying the blitz, or playing relatively well against the blitz. So the calling card was maybe you have to play them like they're going to play Patrick Mahomes in a lot of these games, like the Bills played Patrick Mahomes, right? Where they just sat back and said, we're going to let you dink and dunk. But the Chiefs didn't do that. And I think that was actually very smart, because while sometimes we want to make a big deal about these splits, you know, how quarterbacks play when they're under pressure is the least consistent part of their game. So I think there was more of a chance that Josh Allen was just on a hot streak this season. Not that he doesn't have a high floor still, but he was just on a super hot streak this season. So we probably should add less confidence that he really was this blitz killer, that he could just destroy the blitz. And Spagnuolo just said, you know, we're not going to change what we do. We're going to continue to do that and bet on the fact that maybe that's going to come back to earth because of the fact that that's so inconsistent, how quarterbacks play against the blitz.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Like, the inconsistency as opposed to, like, quarterbacks who play well versus the blitz versus when they don't. I mean, Justin Herbert is a good example. He was horrible against the blitz in college. Like, that's why I keep watching him at the NFL level, and I'm like, how was this guy this good? Because his senior year, he was so bad against, you know, pressure. And this year, he turned into a pretty solid quarterback. But yeah,
I think he was our highest rated. At one point, he was our highest graded quarterback under pressure. You know, so it's just like, whoa, out of nowhere,
which
right?
Which is absurd. That's what I'm saying. So it's like, is there a regression to the mean that's due for Josh Allen? I mean, I don't know. That's the thing, like, moving forward, because I think he's going to have games where he obliterates teams against the blitz. I think that it'll be like 3 games out of 4 that he's going to be able to do that. It depends on, again, like, who is surrounding him, who's supporting Cassis. When you have 5 guys, and really the Bills have probably the best receiving corps in the league, at least one of them. When you talk about Stephon Diggs, Cole Beasley, Gabe Davis, that's a pretty solid trio. And they weren't able to generate any type of separation against Kansas City's guys this past weekend. And it really hurt what Josh Allen was able to do. So I think it kind of goes hand in hand. I think watching what the receivers were able to do and what they weren't able to do, and Josh Allen just kind of getting flustered and reverting back to, you know, kind of old habits, especially taking like the really, really bad sacks and trying to extend plays too long. I think that's who he is. Like, this is the funny part, and sorry to ramble so much, but like,
go ahead.
If you've said Josh Allen stinks, or if you said Josh Allen is really good, you are right, because that's just, he is. Like, he played, there's a really low floor, I feel like, but I think the ceiling is so high. And for so much of the season, he was able to consistently play at that high potential that a lot of us saw coming out of college. Like, the talent has always been there. It's just that he wasn't able to put together. I think moving forward, he'll probably be that type of streaky quarterback where, you know, you'll have like three really good games, and then the fourth one, you'll be like, well, that looks like Josh Allen from his, you know, second year in the NFL.
Yeah, it's, you know, okay, this comes into play also because of he's now eligible after this season for an extension, for a new contract. And generally, if you know you have the quarterback you want, the earlier the better, because you're putting these years on the end of another season and a fifth-year option, and then you're putting these on the end. So we're talking about, you know, even a 4-year contract, it's really a 6-year window that you're getting against this cap, which will hopefully be rising. And then, you know, the negatives of COVID and everything else are already built into those numbers. Now, it's funny when you mentioned the floor there, because I agree he still like has a huge variance from side to side.
Right.
I think the floor, though, I was kind of encouraged by the floor, because when he talked about his playoff performances, I mean, that game against the Texans last year, some of the plays were, I mean, it was glorious. Don't get me wrong. It was incredible. Like the attempted lateral, throwing the ball into triple coverage with the fullback down on the wheel route, you know, 30 yards downfield, and just other things to do. I mean, it was like, that was a whole new level. So I think when you look at his grading this year, yeah, I mean he was worse in the playoffs. I mean, I look his grading, he was sub 70 for his grade versus he was about 90 during the season. But, you know, even 70, like he was 70 during the playoffs he was, you know, 60 for his entire season last year. The ups and the downs, right? So he was still playing at a higher level in a bad streak than he was the old Josh Allen was playing for the entire season. So I think in some ways that is encouraging. And he seems to be someone who really wants to, really is working on his game, who is really trying to get better. You don't see quarterbacks. I mean, I think this may have been the greatest leap I've ever seen for someone from their second to third year. Normally, they're pretty, you know, they're not fully developed, but that leap has already happened in their second year, and then there's not as much going forward. So he does seem like someone who works on his game a bit. But you're right, there are certain plays, and it could have been worse in the playoffs because there were twice he got sacked and he fumbled again, once against the Ravens, once against the Colts, where his offensive lineman recovered it. So, I mean, they could have lost to the Colts, right, if that would have happened in week one. And there's these plays like last week where he had three sacks, but I think he took like 150 yards of sack yards on those different plays and the intentional grounding. So, yeah, there are definitely those bonehead plays. But in some ways, I think the floor is higher. Is it high enough, though, to say, here's your $40 million a season? Because I think you have to ask for the Deshaun Watson deal if you're Josh Allen here. Can you sign that over to him at this point? Or do you think there's value despite the noise? Because there's going to be a lot of noise if you don't make that move this offseason. Do you think there's value in saying, hey, you know what, let's lock in that fifth-year option. Let's let it play out another season. And then, you know, we have multiple franchise tags. We have all kinds of time to decide what we're going to do.
I think you have to, you know, re-sign him at this point. To me, especially, I think it's really big that they were able to retain Brian Daboll. Like, for him to not get a head coaching job during this cycle was really, really big, I think, for Allen moving forward, because what he was able to do in terms of development. Like, I loved your piece about it, like how Allen made this miraculous, you know, third year leap. I don't know if he's going to regress too much. Like, and that's the thing. Like I was saying earlier, I think, three games out of four, you're going to get a Josh Allen who's closer to the potential, like the high potential player that, you know, he's capable of being, as opposed to getting that fourth game where maybe, you know, the floor for that fourth game is a little bit lower, even though you'll get sprinkles of the boneheaded plays like the bad sacks or, you know, just throwing in the triple coverage or doing something really weird. But I think as time progresses with him, I think you're going to see less of that. And I think it makes more sense to lock him down now because quarterback play is such a premium. Like, for him to even be an average player, if he were to somehow like regress and precipitate, like, to, you know, being a mid-tier player, I think, you know, Buffalo, for them, that would be solid because I honestly trust what Brandon Bean can build around him on both sides of the ball. They've given him all the weapons offensively. They've gone after very aggressive defensive backs. They've built their defensive line really, really well. I just trust like what that organization would be able to do in terms of maximizing the talent that's already there. Because there's not too many quarterbacks in the NFL, at least moving forward, who will be 6'5", 240 or whatever he is, be able to run the football and also pass as well and chuck the ball 60 yards downfield, flicking it when he's falling out of bounds like that. The talent is just too much to pass up on, and we've seen what he's capable of. So it just makes sense to sign him.
Yeah. I agree. And again, it's one of those things where hopefully you can structure it in a way with the additional years that you're not necessarily going to be super under the gun. And I don't think their cap situation is really awful there either. They don't have a lot of highly paid players. I thought the Tre'Davious White contract was really looked pretty good, honestly. It was very good in comparison to someone. I mean, he's not on the same level as Jalen Ramsey, but there was such a huge gap there that it was good to see that they weren't paying, you know, top-notch dollars there for a player who's maybe in the bottom of a top-tier type of player there. So I guess for you know, so we talked about the fact that he could probably be extended. Now I got to get into some of these McDermott plays, unfortunately, to see what's going on here. And I mean, there's not really that much to say, quite honestly. They had the 4th-and-3, and there's an interesting part is we had the 4th-and-8 at the end of the game for LaFleur. We concentrate on that a ton, even though there was a tiny bit of value there. Now, the worst decision from a win probability standpoint was the first quarter decision, where I don't think people thought about it a lot because it's 4th-and-3, and 4th-and-3 is not necessarily go for it every time. But the fact that you're in this no man's land, and they ended up kicking a 51-yard field goal. Now, they made the 51-yard field goal, but that's not a gimme. So the fact that you're going like a pretty difficult field goal rather than go for it on 4th-and-3, that was the worst one. The one that's getting a lot more attention, which was also much, much worse than the LaFleur decision, was and not to attempt it from the 2-yard line right before half, which if they scored, I'm trying to think what it would have cut it to at that point. I think it would have cut it to 5 at that point if they scored. So they ended up kicking it instead. Do you, and you know, the explanation afterwards, McDermott said he wanted to get the points, isn't that? Is there any justification for this? Is there, like, I'm trying to figure out how I can wrap my head around this, because the Bills were really, really good at going for it when they should have been going for 3 years now. Did he just get tight? Was there just, is that what happened to McDermott in this situation?
I think it's like, I guess I'd attribute it to false confidence and false hope, I guess, because, you know, typically against, I guess you would think just about any other quarterbacks outside of Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes, like you think, okay, cool. Like I'll kick a field goal to give my team, you know, like you said, the morale of being down 9 points as opposed to what was it? 12, which, you know, it's still a 2-possession game. But I guess, you know, the morale of that is like, hey, we got points on the board. We're going to slow them down in the second half and get right back in the game. Problem is, you're going up against Patrick Mahomes or all these other elite quarterbacks who you are assuming you're going to slow down. I think that's the wrong presumption, is that, you know, you're thinking that you're going to be able to catch them on, in terms of points. When you have an opportunity, again, like, you know, the coaches and this control, you control, when you can pull yourself within one possession from the 2-yard line, there's no excuse for you not attempting to be aggressive, and especially in a win-lose situation with a Super Bowl on the line, potentially. Like, it doesn't make sense to me that, you know, he decided in that situation to go and kick the field goal. So, yeah, it seems like he just got tight and just kind of overthought it. You're at the 2-yard line.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he also mentioned how Kansas City was getting the ball first in the second half as a reason to kick it, where, yeah, again, I understand that you don't want to suddenly look up and, you know, 90 seconds into the third quarter, you're down 19 points. And I think that was really what he was most concerned about. But it's like you almost need points more, because Kansas City is likely to get an extra possession in the second half. So you're even in a relatively worse spot than what you thought at being down. You're not just normal down 12 at that point, but it's even worse than being, and you're going against the Chiefs. Yeah. Anyway, there's nothing really we could say about this. I mean, other than, I don't know, he must have had someone in his headset telling him what to do, because he's been so good at doing this. So that's another reason that I'm very, very surprised, because he definitely had someone telling him, and this had to be a veto overrule type of situation. And it just, you know, yeah, we can't really explain it going forward. In these uncertain times, life is full of questions, like when should I start thinking about life insurance? But however difficult these questions may be, Western and Southern can help you answer them. Backed by over 130 years of experience, together we can look ahead to leave the unknown behind. Western and Southern Financial Group, life insurance, retirement, and investments. Compensated endorser, products issued by member companies of Western and Southern Financial Group, Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, one other thing I wanted to mention about the Chiefs and the Super Bowl here and kind of how they're performing in the playoffs. I'm wondering if, again, you know, you're a young guy here, so you don't have as much experience with old GOAT Michael Jordan as you do with LeBron James. You're probably a LeBron guy. Are you a LeBron guy or not?
I am a LeBron guy. Oh,
yeah,
man.
Of course. You have to be. You have to stick. You got to stick with the younger crowd there. But it reminds me a little bit, these last two seasons with Patrick Mahomes, it reminds me a little bit of these Michael Jordan seasons, where there were a couple different times where, you know, they got, you know, the 70 wins once, and they did that during the regular season and were dominant. But there are other times where they didn't have home court advantage in the finals playing against Utah. Karl Malone won the MVP. And then in the playoffs, it became the playoffs. And I feel like this is a little bit of what's going on with Patrick Mahomes now, is, you know, he didn't win the MVP last year. He didn't win the MVP this year, probably. We haven't seen it yet. But he didn't win it. I guess Pro Football Writers Association already came out with theirs, and they gave it to Rodgers. And I think that'll happen for AP too. I mean, maybe it's one of those types of situations where everybody knows who the best player is, but you have to give the award to the player who had the best regular season, and then Mahomes is just ready to, you know, rip out your heart when time comes to it in the playoffs.
Yeah, no, it's a great comparison, right? Like, and I know that it probably seems early for a lot of people to make that comparison, but you know, like I was saying earlier, like before Patrick Mahomes, like Aaron Rodgers was the most talented player, but now it's like Mahomes has the talent and he has the kind of clutch and luck factor that Tom Brady had, you know, very early on in his career. But I think, you know, Stephen Ruiz like was tweeting about earlier. I didn't pay too like look too into it, but you know, like early on in Brady's career, you know, he relied on those defenses so much. Mahomes won an MVP like his first year as a starter. Like this is a guy who is legitimately the best player in the league at 25 years old. And so as far as like him being able to turn it on, regardless of whether he's winning, you know, MVPs and awards and whatnot, you know, it's just a fact of the matter that, you know, this is a guy who is going to find a way. Like, that's the thing. If Tampa Bay goes up in the Super Bowl, I'm not going to be shocked at all. Neither should anybody really else, considering the comebacks that he's able to mount in the playoffs previously, when you talk about the Texans last year and even against the Titans last year, and then the 9-point comeback in the first half, he evaporated that within the second quarter. So yeah, it's just a different type of player. I don't know how, like there's nothing really to describe, you know, what we're watching at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it's getting really tough for me, but I've been someone who has held out a little bit on the Tom Brady GOAT thing. Now it's so I'm kind of hoping for, like, can we fast forward Patrick Mahomes' career so I can just put him as the GOAT and not have to put Tom Brady there? And part of the reason is what you talked about. I mean, okay, it shouldn't matter like the draft pedigree and that sort of stuff, but let's face it. I mean, Tom Brady, he was a 6th-round pick. He sat for a while. He was, I mean, supposedly when they brought him in for Bledsoe, it was almost like a coin flip. They were deciding which backup they were gonna put in there. He hadn't really, you know, shown himself that to that level. And like you mentioned, you know, he started winning these Super Bowls. I guess it was back in 2003, maybe was the first one. But so he started winning these Super Bowls pretty. It was 2001. It was pretty early.
Oh wow.
And then he didn't win MVP until 2007. So I mean, it's not like, but that was really like he took the performance to a level where he was starting to match, you know, Peyton Manning and some of these other guys who hadn't had the sort of success there. So I think for a reason, I've kind of been a little bit of a hater on Tom Brady for that reason. But now he's just really making it hard. And if he wins this championship, it's going to be nearly impossible. I may have to capitulate and just hope that Mahomes can come around here. All right. So well. You know, I'm sure there'll be plenty of time to talk more Super Bowl, but I just want to talk the one other piece of business here. And I wrote something about Matthew Stafford here. Maybe you can convince me. What is your opinion on Stafford? Because I feel like he's a guy who is viewed always at, in my opinion, the high end of maybe how he's played. I mean, he was a number one pick. Was he a true number one pick prospect? I mean, probably. He probably had that sort of talent. He was the highest paid quarterback in the NFL when he signed an extension, despite the fact that he was good, but he hadn't been great. And then now going into the trade market, there's talk as if any team, you know, picks him up, throw a couple of first round picks or maybe more at them, and boom, you're competing for a championship potentially with him there. Do you think that he is really worth that type of investment for a team in free agency? And there should be really a bidding war, which there may be over bringing him in for teams who want to compete this season.
Well, I know that he provided stability for Detroit, and I know that's probably not saying a lot, but for a franchise that, you know, has had so much bad luck for what, 50, 60 years or whatever it is, like, that's a pretty big deal for him to have performed that as high a level as he did. And like you're saying, it wasn't always consistently a high level, but I don't think he was in an organization or even on a team in a situation where he was, you know, due to prosper. He dragged Detroit to 3 or 4 playoff appearances, which, you know, is pretty decent. Like, as far as him being, you know, on a quarterback tier, he's like squarely in that above average portion. I don't know if he'd like be a top 5 guy. I don't know if there's ever been a point in his career where he's come close to being a top 5 quarterback. But I mean, the talent has always been there. The guy has just been in a situation, at least to me, where, you know, outside of, you know, the early or at least the middle parts of his career where, you know, he had like Jim Caldwell and Calvin Johnson was still there. Like, I don't think Detroit has really ever had, like, I mean, Kenny Galladay is cool. Like, he's a solid weapon. TJ Hockenson's pretty nice. DeAndre Swift is cool. But it's like, I think you put him in an organization that is really missing a quarterback that is set to compete. I think that he'll surprise people. I guess I'm higher on Stafford than most people are. I just think he's a squarely above average quarterback, which is honestly, it's so important and can get you, you know, so far. You know, we look at the past 5 years, quarterbacks who have made, you know, title or NFC title games include Case Keenum, Nick Foles, and I think Blake Bortles in the AFC 1 year. So it's like, why not Matt Stafford?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Stafford is, I looked at his weapons over time. Yeah. I guess that's one of the things where, you know, Calvin Johnson has actually been running routes for almost half of his career dropbacks. Now, a lot of those came early in his career when he was throwing the ball, you know, like 700 times a season or whatever it was when they were down so much. So maybe that conflates it a bit. Golden Tate, let's not forget Golden Tate. I mean, it is prime.
He was pretty good.
So he's like kind of the other guy that was around there for about 40%. Marvin Jones Jr., depending upon what you think of him. He's been around for a while. But yeah, he didn't have much depth outside of that. They spent a first-round pick on Brandon Pettigrew at tight end, who never worked out. Eric Ebron, famously, a couple of picks before Odell Beckham Jr. that they spent in the first round where it didn't work out. So, yeah, they haven't had a lot there. Their offensive line has been okay, but not great. I guess my thing is when I look at him and I say, what about someone like a Derek Carr, let's say?
Yeah.
How much better is he than Derek Carr? And if Derek Carr requested to be traded, what would someone give for Derek Carr? Second round pick? Something like that? Ooh. Where we're talking about multiple firsts for Matthew Stafford. Or would someone give more for Derek Carr? I don't want Derek Carr to block the podcast somehow. But if he hears this. That's my thing. I just feel like, what incremental benefit are you getting over in a season when, you know, there are gonna be a lot of names out there to potentially be had also. So I think that's an interesting thing. You're not necessarily going to lock them down early, but there are going to be names who are going to be floating out there, whether it's Teddy Bridgewater or Jameis Winston or, you know, rookies that are coming into play. Like Gardner Minshew, I don't know about that. But there's some other, Cam Newton could potentially be out there. So there are some names that I think are interesting. But you Andy Dalton, but then you think like locking in that, he definitely has the higher floor, so that's it, versus those other names, and that you think that is worth it.
I think that's highly valuable because that's the thing, especially for like let's say Washington, right? They had so much. I guess it's hard to pick one quarterback, but the floor for those guys was so low, like, and the ceiling for like let's say an Alex Smith that year, it wasn't that high. Like, great story, right? Don't get me wrong, Alex Smith, great story this year, but he didn't have that much to offer. He's not going to put your offense over the next level. You put Taylor Heinicke in there and all of a sudden they look competitive against the Buccaneers. So I think like with a team like that, where, you know, the floor for them is already high. And if you bring in a Matt Stafford, whose floor is equally in like similar realm, you're not having a quarterback who's going to drag you back from reaching your potential. I think that's what's valuable. And I mean, you look at so many of these quarterbacks who are in that middle tier and below, I think, when you look at a quarterback as far like on Stafford's level, it for 1 year, at least for if you're a team who is trying to contend right now, that investment of a first round pick would be valuable right now because you're getting a quarterback who's going to offer you stability with also a high ceiling. So I think that's why it's valuable. And I think as far as like the Derek Carr and Matt Stafford comparison, I think, they're in similar tiers. I think like if you're going to trade, you know, a first round pick for Stafford, you're definitely trading a first round pick for Derek Carr. And maybe the ceiling is somewhat capped for both of them, but the floor, I think, is what you're investing in. So that way they're not holding your team back.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think this is, I mean, he's going to turn 33 pretty soon. So that's still pretty young, I would say. I mean, I'm trying to think of other instances where a quarterback who at least is perceived to be this good. I mean, if you look at Mike Sando at the Athletic, he puts together this quarterback tiers piece where he talks to 50 executives. Stafford came off of a good season, a good shortened season, a good 8-week season. I think he was ninth, above Matt Ryan, above Dak Prescott, above Philip Rivers, although, you know, Rivers obviously, some of these guys are a little bit later on in their career, but still, you know, solidly in that top 10. So I'm trying to think when in the past, you know, a 33-year-old quarterback who is perceived potentially to be a top 10 guy would be let go. Are you surprised that the Lions are doing this?
I'm not surprised they're allowing it because it's a new regime. And I think there's an understanding, at least for Stafford. I mean, this would have been his fourth, you know, different head coaching regime and fifth, if you include Daryl Bevel. I don't think he wants to be a part of a rebuild. And I think that's what they're trying to do in Detroit. So it makes sense to allow a veteran to, you know, go out, especially I know that it'll cost them. I think, what is it, $19 million against their cap in dead space. Forgive me for not knowing that number off the top of my head, but you know, like it's worth the investment moving forward, especially because they hold the number 7 pick in the draft. If they wanted to, they could potentially try to select a quarterback if, you know, the top 4 guys don't go off the board by then. But, you know, it just gives them a fluidity, I guess, like in terms of moving forward. You're not wasting, you know, a quarterback's career, and you're also getting the opportunity to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I do think it's one of these transactions that makes sense, but also we just didn't see it before. Right. And I think we didn't see it before with a lot of the player movement that we've seen recently. We definitely never seen anything like Deshaun Watson if that ends up happening. So maybe the NFL is becoming a little bit less stayed in its ways in comparison to places like the NBA. And you can kind of get these win-win type of transactions. And, you know, I'm all for it, right? I'm all for it to see some of these guys in different uniforms, and hopefully makes the offseason a little bit more exciting, I think, too, rather than spending the entire time trying to figure out which draft pick you love the most, which is basically just flipping coins for eventually what'll end up happening a few miles down the road. Which reminds me, buy the PFF draft guide, of course. I'll just throw that out there as a little plug, as I mentioned that it's all pointless. Anyway, Kalen, I thank you so much for spending the time here with me. Follow Kalen on Twitter at Kalen Jones. Read everything that he puts out. Listen to the NFL, the Ringer NFL show, where he's on there too. And there's like 5 billion podcasts I listen to at this point. Have you noticed this? Are you suffering from the same phenomenon now? Because I was tracking it the other day. It used to be Bill Barnwell and Robert Mays on a podcast together. Yep. Then it was Bill Barnwell's podcast and Ringer show. And then now it's Robert Mays has come off of the Ringer show, but the Ringer show still exists. And then you had Mina Kimes guesting on Bill Barnwell's show. And now she has her own pod. It's really like you need 1,000 hours and it's very strong eardrums to listen to all these podcasts. But I definitely recommend the Ringer podcast at the top of there. And once again, I thank you for joining me.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.